This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today would probably have been surprised himself at the prospect of his one day becoming North Carolina Teacher of the Year. That's because he didn't set out to be a teacher. He simply gradually realized he already was one. Let's quickly add, he must be a pretty darn good one. For the past several months, James Ford has been traveling the state, speaking to people about education as a kind of ambassador for North Carolina's 95,000 teachers. He teaches history, world history, at Garinger High School and is the first CMS teacher since 1970 to receive the honor of being the state's Teacher of the Year. Since public schools in general and CMS in particular are badly in need of some good news, we are pleased that James Ford could join us today for the hour. Welcome to the program. I watched some of your videos last night on your website. You are remarkable. Where were you when I was in high school?
Well, you made me sound like a pretty big deal. Now I got to live up to that, huh?
Yes, you do.
I'm very grateful to be here, by the way. Just wanted to let you know that off top. But, you know, I've always tried to be the teacher that I think I desperately needed when I was in high school.
And you had one, didn't you?
Yeah. I had a particular one, Mr. Ernest Stokes, who really changed the whole arc and trajectory of my life.
How did he do it?
Really, he was provoked. He's provoked by me.
As they so often are.
Yeah. I was a provocateur. I was very good at that. And so while in his class, on the first day of class, actually, I was cutting up so bad that he had to stop the class and pull me outside and look me in my face and tell me, look, I can tell that you're smart. I can tell that you have a ton of potential. And I could teach you so much if you would just listen. And he was a legendary teacher. So for him to have to do that for me, it gave me pause and it forced me to say, you know what? I got to prove this guy right for taking the time to not ream me, but talk to me about
what
who
did he
thinks
teach?
I am. He taught honors English, but really he taught life. You know, you never felt like it was an English class because you really just you took journeys to every subject matter, every discipline all over the world. But you learned English inherent in that. And so that feeling, right, of, you know what, I'm going to expose you to everything, but I'm also going to deliver content. I've always tried to pattern myself after Mr. Stokes.
I was thinking about teachers that I had in high school, and there are four that stick out in my mind. And that was a long time ago. But there were four teachers, and they stuck out because, just like Mr. Stokes, you didn't know what discipline they were teaching. They were teaching you life.
Right.
And I don't know, do teachers have the power and the freedom and the flexibility to do that today?
I would argue they do. I wouldn't say that every teacher believes that they do, though, because it depends on district. It depends on school, whether they're relinquished to do so. I think one of the things teachers crave most is the freedom to interpret, the freedom to adjust the curriculum according to the needs of their student and take those sort of liberties and risks. But it's all about the environment. I've been blessed to have, you know, administrators, academic facilitators who encouraged risk-taking in the classroom and doing different things, right, thinking outside the box. But other places, it's more conventional. It's more to the script of what we believe education to be, which is very lockstep and very conventional. I always charge teachers to say, you know, try to do the best that you can in incorporating as many different elements, ideas, as long as you can justify it legitimately by your curriculum.
And we hear so much about having to teach to the test because that's what's going to be – that's how you grade not only the students but the teachers as well.
Right.
So how can you have the freedom to go off script, so to speak, and inspire kids if all you have – in the back of your mind, you're thinking, I'm going to be judged. They're going to be judged by what happens on this test.
I think that's an excellent question. I mean, on the one hand, it does disincentivize that process, right? I mean, whenever you judge teachers primarily on their test scores, it does stifle some of that creative instinct. However, this is an art. Teaching is an art, and despite the conditions and the way that we frame it, I believe that to be the case. And so after you master the content yourself, you got to start finding different ways. And that comes with practice, right? After you've taught a course several times, you begin to say, okay, what else can I incorporate to spice this up a little bit? Maybe I can pull from here. Maybe I can pull from there. But you have to begin, yes, by making sure your objectives are aligned to the standards and that you're teaching the content.
I've never heard anybody say that teaching is an art. I think you're absolutely right.
Absolutely.
And the problem here, it seems to me, is a problem that is rampant in America.
Uh-huh.
and that is the MBA. Not the NBA, the MBA, because they want to run everything like a business. You can run the school like a business, but you can't run the classroom like one.
No, no. We're this
and the two philosophies don't get along.
Not necessarily. You know what? I'm all for, you know, sound fiscal practices and, you know, looking at return on investment and those kind of ideas. Those have resonance in education. But like you said, in the classroom, you can measure educator effectiveness, but you need to make sure that you understand we're dealing with humans here. Right. We're not manufacturing products. Right. This is not input output. It's not that simple. And it is an art form. And every teacher has their own style, even if they've yet to discover it. Right. Some are more realist. Some are more impressionist. Some are more avant-garde. Whatever it is, you need to find that style and master it. But you have to be given the freedom to do so.
What is yours?
I would say I'm more avant-garde.
Yeah. Because you're a really fascinating person because at one point in your life, you were intending to be a professional rapper.
Yes, absolutely.
And you did do it professionally.
Yeah.
And then you went on, I think, I'm trying to find my notes here. Give me your career path.
I really started doing music from 13 years old. I was doing performances all the way through high school. In the early 20s, I released some, you know, independent stuff, mm-hmm. did shows for a long time. But just decided that, you know, the way that music was going and even in my music, my intention was to teach, mm-hmm. Was to impart knowledge and so forth. So, after working with some kids though, and doing volunteer work and working in a nonprofit, I decided, you know what, this is probably not the place that I could best dedicate my time and skills. And so I transitioned into going back and getting my master's in arts and teaching. And became a teacher, but I still incorporate hip-hop and music into the class.
Yeah, you do some live rapping in the classroom on world history.
Yes, I do.
That'll get their attention.
Yeah, and it does, and they're always like blown back initially when they're like, wow, you can rap. And I might even challenge a couple of them and say, you know, if you think you can rap, you know, see me at the class, we'll trade some verses, you know. Uh-huh. And you'll probably have to go home and write a new one, but usually that's it.
I mean, it puts that world history world into their world.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Because I feel like I live in their world. And so why not make world history centered around the students? You know, this is in this galaxy, in this solar system, we think that everything revolves around the teachers and students are the sun, right? Everything should revolve around them.
Hmm. One of your students said of you that, I'm going to paraphrase here, that you make them feel like you are one of them, that you understand them because you're just like them. You can rap, you like rap, you like hip-hop. Somehow you're relatable, and it doesn't hurt, I suppose, that you have dreadlocks.
Yeah.
Talk about that. I mean, there's a fine line between being too chummy and too much like a student.
That's right.
And being their teacher who relates to them. So how do you make that?
I'm glad you bring that up because I've learned, there's two ways to learn. You can learn how to do something, how not to do something. And I've seen those who try to be too cool, and I've seen those who don't appear to be human in front of their students. So I've tried to strike the balance, and that's the highest compliment ever because I remember feeling as a student like nobody understood me. And I always charged myself. I said, you know, if ever I get a chance to work with young people, I'm going to make sure that they know that we remember what it was like to be 15. Yeah. You know, you remember what it was like, what you thought about the world.
Well, I was going to ask you because what you do, right, you're not very old. I don't know what your age is.
I like to think so.
You're in your mid-30s. But when you're in – if you're still in the classroom in your late 40s and early 50s, mm-hmm. are you going to be able to do that at some point? It seems to me you cross over.
Yeah.
Are you still going to be able to relate to these young people?
And you know what? I would say that yes, only because some of it may be pride. Some of it may be I've seen it done with teachers who are older than I am. I think the thing is not to try to be 15, right? That's not what you should try to do. You don't try to dress like them and everything else. It's always to remain relatable. Uh-huh. And that's something I don't care how old you are. You can always inject humor, always interject, you know, freedom of expression. That, as long as you encourage that, I think that resonates with kids.
Your path to teaching, getting back to that, you became a truancy officer, working with kids who were habitually truant.
Absolutely.
And then you were involved in after-school programs for kids, and you realized that a lot of the kids you were working with as a truancy person were showing up for the after-school programs.
Yeah.
And that's what led you into education. What – you have always worked with young people who are having a difficult time.
Right.
Particularly with education.
Mm-hmm.
What is something that we don't understand? Those of us who did not come from that world,
sure.
What don't we understand about those young people?
That every child has a story, and it may not be easily discernible on the surface, right? The waters on top may be very, very calm, but underneath that, there's an undertow, right? There is a riptide that is oftentimes pulling kids down. Situations, these kids are soldiers. You know, to be able to be as resilient as they are, to have endured or seen the things that they have, and wake up every day with a level of optimism to at least, you know, try to approach life with some sort of ambition. That takes a lot that a lot of people probably don't know about. And myself, I never personally experienced those things, but the willingness and the openness to at least hear mm-hmm. and to empathize, to attempt to place myself in their shoes. Young people don't get that on a regular basis. So when you build those relationships, when they know that you care, then they'll reciprocate that.
Is that what they want?
Yes.
Out of a teacher, they want somebody who cares.
Absolutely. But they're going to put you through the test because they don't want to be disappointed. Because mm-hmm. you're not the first person who's come and said that you care. Mm-hmm. You know, and so as a defense mechanism, they have to, you know, have the hard outer exterior, but they're M&Ms, you know.
So they're pushing you away to see if you'll stick?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And once you cross the threshold, whatever their arbitrary criteria is, I mean, you're going to experience a love that you've never felt before.
How do you know when you're being played?
Oh, man. Some of that is learned by experience. You know?
And what do you do about it when you've been played?
I gotta come back and let the kid know, look, I know you're playing me, okay? Or I know that you played me. Just to let them know, not out of a sense of pride, but to let them know that sometimes people can call your stuff, right? They can see it. And I want you to know so that you don't go about thinking that you're fooling people, right? Now then, once you do that, you can't take that personal, okay, because it's not about you. They picked that habit up or that behavior up someplace else. Mm-hmm. You have to let them know that despite that fact, there's redemption, right? You're still redeemable. Let's figure out a way for you to be more earnest, more, you know, genuine in your approach, because this in the long run is not going to help you. It's happened, though. It has absolutely happened. And, you know, there's kids who think they're playing you. Sometimes you let them feel that way. Like, okay, that's your phone. All right. You know, but you don't have the password. You need me to help. Okay. You know, but you have to, I think you have to remain. You can't sit in the seat of judgment with kids. Right. You can't do that because they're kids.
Wow. We have so much to talk about. James Ford is with us. He is a history teacher or has been a history teacher at Geringer High School. He's taking a year off because he's the North Carolina Teacher of the Year. And one of the things that people who win that award do is travel to state as an ambassador for the other 95,000 teachers in the state and join boards of education and advise the State Board of Education and things like that. I want to talk about how that's going, too, because I'm not sure they want to hear what you have to say.
It's debatable.
We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks at WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and historic South End, with over 200 shops offering unique gifts for everyone on your holiday shopping list. This Saturday, celebrating Small Business Saturday, details at historicsouthend.com. And Donald Hack Diamonds, celebrating with a holiday open house at their new location in Morrowcroft Village in South Park, December 4th through the 6th. Details and holiday schedule at donaldhack.com. Well, tomorrow on Thanksgiving, we go deep into the archives for a surprising and unexpected yet uplifting conversation. A homeless man with a young son becomes a stockbroker and later the head of his own successful brokerage firm. I know it sounds like the stuff of movies, because it was. Will Smith's The Pursuit of Happiness, the name of the movie. But that movie was based on a book by Chris Gardner, and the story it told was his story. It's kind of a rags-to-riches tale, but he says it's a love story between a father and son, and he'll be here to explain it all tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Food and Drug Administration will require movie theaters, chain restaurants, and pizza parlors to include calorie counts for food and beverages, including alcohol. Costs and benefits of the new rules.
Tune in the Diane Rehm Show coming up next from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is James Ford, North Carolina Teacher of the Year, the first CMS teacher to be so named since 1970. Front and center on your website is this statement: teaching is the one profession that all other professions are dependent upon. Are those your words?
Are any ideas really original? Uh-huh. I'm sure I probably, heard it someplace, but the phraseology and the point of that statement is absolutely true.
Do you think people believe that? Do they understand it? Do they know it? Do they acknowledge it? Does the legislature, does the state school board, do your fellow teachers, do the students?
Wow, that was a big question. I think people, when they hear it, when you hear a truth, I think you know what it is by the way that it rings. And so once you introduce that statement, people are like, yeah, I guess that's true. Now, in the way that we're treated, in the way that, the behaviors of legislators, of administrators, of board members, the behaviors they exhibit, absolutely not. For whatever reason, there is this pushback against the educational profession that leads to like a very almost an anti-intellectual environment where you think education is important, at least in word. But when it comes to resource allocation, when it comes to bolstering the profession of teaching, those words oftentimes ring hollow. There's a general lack of support, a lack of regard for teachers. We're viewed as glorified babysitters, underqualified, incompetent.
And you said somewhere in one of the talks that you've been giving around the state that teachers – people who teach are viewed as people who can't do anything else. And
yeah.
They're it's a low-skill profession.
Absolutely.
On the contrary.
On the contrary, right. This is a skilled profession. As I mentioned before, it's an art form. And the skill sets that we deploy in the classroom are transferable anywhere.
When did that happen? When I was a kid, if I acted up in classroom, not only did my parents hear about it, they took the side of the teacher.
Right.
That doesn't happen much anymore.
Those are the days, huh?
Yeah. And teachers were important people. We looked up to our teachers.
Yeah.
Our parents pointed to teachers and said, that's a good teacher. You pay attention to that person.
Yeah.
What happened?
It's hard to say. I personally try to investigate that issue myself. And I would say it's a development of the last two decades. Because as you mentioned before, it was a highly regarded profession. It was public service, you were a role model when you were a teacher in your community. But there's been this divestment, right? There's been this mechanical, industrial approach to teaching where people just kind of got the idea, this doesn't look that hard. Anybody can teach, what's the problem? And a lot of it has is translated into breaking up of school systems now. And so now I think that the lack of respect for the profession, the lack of respect for what happens and all of the inputs that affect educational outcomes, I feel like are now manifesting themselves through people not only delegitimating the profession, but delegitimating public education. Now that's feeding into the choice movement, the school choice movement, I believe, because people are saying public schools are broken. Let's find someplace else because they're not doing a great job.
Is that a code word, a code phrase? Public schools are broken.
At least in part, even if unintentionally. And I'll be forthright in telling you that the majority of students in the public school system throughout the nation are now minority students. Mm-hmm. Okay. And 2/3 of those minority students in public schools go to schools that are overwhelmingly minority. So the majority minority, and half of those schools are schools of high poverty. So I think you can delineate what I'm saying is that, you know, even within public schools, minority students and poor students tend to go to school with each other, while more affluent white students go to racially more homogenous schools. Mm-hmm. And so when you make a statement like public schools are broken, and when you say things like school choice, what can be grafted from that is at least some tinge of classism and race issues embedded in that.
Mm-hmm. What makes for a good teacher?
Number one, passion. If you don't love what you do, the kids will be able to decipher that very quickly. But passion alone doesn't do it. Dedication, building upon your work, mastering the craft, dedicating yourself to developing as a teacher, being honest, sitting under mentors, collaborating, constantly challenging yourself, taking risks, but taking stock, taking inventory of the ways that you can improve yourself. You have to remain true to this profession.
Here's something else that people think about teachers. As you're sitting there talking, I'm thinking people mm-hmm. think, yeah, the hell, they only work 9 months a year. They work 8 to 3. That's it. They teach the same thing over and over again. They don't have to challenge themselves. It's hard, hard work to do what you do the way you do it.
Sure.
Talk about your day.
Oh, man. A typical day, you got to kind of get there early, if not to perform your duties, because you have duties outside of the classroom to make sure that the school environment is safe. But just to kind of get your mind ready, because you're going to be giving a performance several times, right? And so you need to make sure you're mentally ready for all the things that could befall you. And so every class is different. You have classes where it may be relatively calm. Everybody's engaged. You know, there's rigor taking place. It's going off without a hitch. And then you have classes where it requires more of you, maybe more disruptions, more off-task behavior. You may lesson plan something and it goes just the way that you planned it to in one particular class. The next class, it is a train wreck. Mm-hmm. And you have to figure out how you're going to do it with the next class that's coming. You don't get much time to recalibrate. You get 15 minutes as they're passing through. After the day is over, you may have students that stay after who need tutoring, who need more individualized attention that you weren't able to give them in that classroom. You may be advising a group or a mentorship program like I was, or have some sort of staff meeting afterwards. Usually, school begins at 7:15. You're there by 6:45 mandated. And usually I would probably leave by 4:30. And by that time, you know, I got to go home to my kids who don't care that I had a long day, you know, right. It's the second shift. So,
when do you have time to grade papers?
And when they go to bed. When they go to bed, so like around 8:30, and you may be grading for several hours, grading and lesson planning. My first year of teaching, I went to bed perpetually at 1 o'clock in the morning every night.
And you were back at school at 6:45.
Absolutely. So,
and for that, they paid you the grand sum of?
Oh, wow. I topped out at about 38. That's with the master's degree. So that's where I've been at for the past several years.
With your master's degree working in private industry, mm-hmm. what could you make?
Oh, man. And I like to think I got a pretty robust skill set. I'm sure I'd be somewhere in the 60s easily.
I think more.
I think
you're being very conservative. I think a lot more. So why do you do this?
Because I'm a martyr. No, I'm just playing. I think we tend to wear that martyrdom, right? You know, because we love the kids so much, and we know the gravity, the power of the work, that it goes so far above and beyond us, that to sacrifice our own income in the process, even though begrudgingly, right, we would not desire for that to be the case, it seems like it's at least justifiable, right? You know what? Maybe I'm not cashing in on all the human capital I've invested in myself, and that should not be the case. But if I can invest human capital in these young people, and if they can go cash in on that investment, then in a way, it kind of still is worth it.
But teacher pay in North Carolina right now is what, 49th in the country?
No longer. It's with the current raise that got passed, I think we're somewhere in the high 30s. Oh. So we're still below average.
Below average, because there are only 50 states.
Right.
Well, last time I cast,
right.
In my American history class, that's where I learned that. but is it – how – we have been told that because of the pay situation in North Carolina, that systems that we used to steal from, are now stealing from us because teachers are going, what? I can make $10,000, $15,000 more in Columbia? I'm gone. I'm going to Columbia.
Yeah.
Or I'm going to Atlanta. Or I'm going to Houston, Texas, of all places. And it seems to me that when teachers, and it's no secret, when teachers are struggling monetarily,
right,
that sends a message to children about the importance of the person in front of them in that classroom.
Kids get it. And that's something I don't think people who aren't in the classroom understand. Let me make this abundantly clear. The young people understand that when you don't pay teachers, implicitly that indicates how you feel about them. They'll tell you bold face. You know, I've had kids say, you know, I would be a teacher, but man, you know, I can't take the way they pay y'all, Mr. Fortin. Why wouldn't they pay you guys when they know you teach in front of us? Like, aren't we important? And they say these type of things in class, and you have to be able to jostle and still make them feel valued, but they get the message. And, you know, the profile of teaching in North Carolina has to be raised, one, because teachers are deserving of it, okay? That's the number one reason. But secondly, because if you're going to attract people to this profession, do this critically important work that's – we're literally handling the most precious commodity that any community can produce, which is young people, right? Then this should be the picture of stability. Right. Teachers should not be begging for bread. This should not be the noble peasantry where you get patted on the head for doing a great job and told that you deserve better, yet no actionable steps are taken.
How do teachers view it when the people above them who are not in the classroom, who are not on the front lines, who are not handling the next generation of people are making several hundred thousand dollars a year? I know this puts you in a very awkward position.
Well, you know, no, not really. I'm used to handling these kind of questions, and I hope I speak accurately on their behalf, but it is in a way it destroys morale. It destroys morale because you love this work. We love this work, but you can't help but look at your cohort, right? Those who you graduated college with, who, you know, went through similar programs, and they're doing fabulously well financially. And you can't help but kind of go back to your reference point, which is, OK, look at me. You know, many teachers work two or three jobs, qualify for public assistance. And although you don't do it for that, people have used that love of education against us because we go around confessing that it's not about the money. It's not I didn't do this because I wanted to get rich. Yes. But as State Superintendent Atkinson said, we also didn't take a vow of poverty either. And so we don't do ourselves any favors. But to answer your question, it is incredibly discouraging because you keep looking back and saying, man, I could be doing so much better. I may not be as happy, but, you know, my kids could go on vacation. I could take them around the world. I could afford to do this. I could do that. And right now we can't.
Why do you love it?
There is just something intrinsic about there's something that is invaluable, that's priceless about seeing a kid grow and knowing that you had some sort of influence on their position or station in life. When you have a student come back to you who was in your class and says, you know what? I know I gave you a hard time, but look at me now. I have a plan. I'm in the military. I'm in school. I'm doing this. I have a family. And when they come back and thank you, you can't pay for that. There's nowhere you can go to obtain that sort of feeling. And everybody wants to feel valued. In a way, it's kind of selfish because we want to feel as if we're making a contribution to society. And teaching allows you to feel that. Some days you don't. But the moments where it manifests itself are moments that are indescribable, that they'll stay with you for the rest of your life. And that sense of contribution is euphoric.
And you've used euphoric as a descriptor a number of times in a number of interviews that I read that you have done about what you feel like when you've broken through.
Yeah.
Before we started the program today, you and I were talking off the air, and I mentioned that years ago I used to read to kids in classrooms and talk about various things in broadcasting to kids. And in the first, second, and third grade, they're all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed.
Right.
They're all raising their hands and they're excited about learning new things. And in about the fourth grade, a significant number of them, the light goes out of their eyes.
Right.
And that light doesn't generally come back on. I'll bet you, though, that you have turned it back on in some people. The light goes out because they're not doing well,
right,
for whatever the reason, in school. So it becomes a negative experience. Nobody wants to go someplace that they hate to be,
right,
or where they're going to feel like a failure.
Absolutely.
Nobody wants that. in any aspect of their life.
That's
so
right.
How do you overcome that? How do you help those kids for whom the light goes out?
You know, when I initially decided to be a teacher, people told me, teach elementary, teach middle school. And those are critically important grades because you're right. That's where a lot of those gaps and that disinvestment personally happens at. And they said, don't do high school because by that time it's too late. Mm. And that was like telling me, go teach high school. Because I was like, somebody's got to be there to grab those kids before they fall over the cliff, you know? And the way that you do that is through relationship building. You've probably heard the phrase, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. That may as well be a teaching proverb, because that ability to turn that light back on comes from loving on kids, comes from conveying to them that you care about their personal well-being above and beyond a grade in your class, comes from reigniting their imagination, you know, introducing them to knowledge that actually applies to their life, that helps improve their ability to think critically, right, to solve problems. To be able to construct arguments. Those are things that are going to benefit every child, and it confirms for them that they can do it, that they are intelligent. Those are the things that I try to focus on that usually, not 100% of the time, but usually are effective.
But you see, maybe people haven't thought about this, but as you've been talking about this, just in that last comment, yeah, you know world history. Yeah, you can get up and tell them when the Magna Carta was signed.
Right.
But it's not about that.
That's right.
It's about so much more than that. Are we asking teachers? It just seems to me we're asking teachers to do so much. Mm-hmm. Are we asking them to do too much?
Well, with regard to, if I understand your question, making their content relevant?
Well, you're like a psychologist. You're
like a
parent.
Oh, yeah.
You're like a best friend. You're like a mentor. You're like somebody bolstering them to push them along to the next level.
But that's what we do.
And you're teaching world history.
Yeah. I mean, but that's when I talk about the skill set. I don't think anybody can step foot into our classroom and do all those things that you mentioned, right? I mean, that's a pretty unique individual to be able to wear all of those hats and deliver content in a way that transcends just that discipline, right, and applies to life that is applicable. Teachers are asked to do that, and I don't think they're rewarded for it, but I don't think we mind doing it because we all know we're amateur psychiatrists. We all know we're case managers. We all know that we're mentors, role models, and so forth, and that's what's enjoyable about it. It would be nice if people regarded us as such and held us in the esteem worthy of one who embodies all of those abilities, right? Because that's a multi-talented individual we're talking about that you just described.
Oh, yeah. I've done a lot of conversations about education over the years on this program, and I have come to a conclusion, which I will share with you, and it could be very, very wrong. But my conclusion is that it all boils down to the parent. Yes, the teacher is really important, but if the parent is not engaged, if the parent isn't on the other side of that equation, you're in real trouble.
You know, it'd be nice if it were that simple.
Okay.
What I will give you is that parental involvement, home environment it plays a huge role in it, but I don't think it's a dichotomous situation. Because we know that the single most influential factor in a child's educational attainment is actually the teacher. That's what all the data suggests, having a highly qualified teacher in front of that student, despite where a child comes from. Because if it comes down to the parents, then what we're saying is that if you don't come from a stable household, you know, too bad, sucks. You should have had better parents, you know. And I don't think that that's the end of the chapter. I don't think that's it.
Let me stop you because we have to take a break.
I'm
going to come back to that in a second here. Our guest today is James Ford. He's the North Carolina Teacher of the Year. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Griffin Brothers Tire, Wheels, and Auto Repair. Family-owned, serving the greater Charlotte area since 1961. 9 convenient locations featuring tire and automotive repair. Details at griffinbrothers.com. And the Children's Theater of Charlotte, celebrating the holidays with the musical production Scrooge. Evening and matinee performances December 5th through the 22nd. Tickets available at ctcharlotte.org. The Food and Drug Administration will require movie theaters, chain restaurants, and pizza parlors to include calorie counts for food and beverages, including alcohol. So Diane Rehm and her guests will talk about the costs and benefits of these new rules. Coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, if you'd like to join our conversation with the Teacher of the Year, James E. Ford, now's the time. Charlotte Talks at WFAE.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. And we're coming right back.
This is Robert Siegel, host of All Things Considered. Find out not only what happened during the day, but why and what happens next by tuning into All Things Considered weekdays from 4 to 6:30 p.m. on WFAE.
Wages and inflation are sort of going hand in hand and have been since the recession. So people aren't feeling like they're getting ahead even if they have a job.
Get the inside story by getting inside the story with All Things Considered on WFAE weekdays from 4 to 6:30 p.m.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Garinger High School World History Teacher and North Carolina Teacher of the Year, James Ford. We were talking about the role parents play in all this. And no, you can't penalize a child
right,
because their parents, either because they had a bad experience in school and can't relate and don't want anything to do with it and don't feel adequate to do anything with it, or because they're working two and three jobs and don't have time to come to parent-teacher conferences, or not equipped, don't have time to help kids with their homework, don't have time really even to be there in the house. These are incredible problems that you're stuck with. But what could parents who don't feel equipped to help, who didn't have a good experience in school, what could they do to help you? Or even parents who did have a good experience and who are interested in their child, what can they do to help you?
There's a couple of things. On an individual basis, they could at least take an interest and promote education, right? Create the atmosphere for educational attainment. I was going to reference, I forgot the professor's name from Princeton, but he was saying that there's data now that suggests that parental involvement itself is not indicative of higher educational achievement, but the quality of interactions. In other words, you go, you know, to somebody's home and NPR is on, right? There's encyclopedias on the shelves, right? There are Time magazines on the table. The expectation is communicated that you will be a scholar, you will be intellectual, you will value learning. You can create the atmosphere that lets young people know that to be educated is important, critically important. But from the other standpoint, maybe parents who don't come from that environment that you just stated, advocate for the schools to help provide social emotional supports for students that don't have that foundation, you know. Because it used to be that students, all of them or most of them, sat on a three-legged stool. That stool, one leg was schools, right? One leg was community, maybe a faith community, and the other leg was the home. Every student does not have all three legs on that stool anymore, maybe one if they're lucky, right? So what can we do as a society, right, and respecting the change of atmosphere now to help fill those gaps, help provide students with support emotionally, to make sure that they're processing the things that are going on at home, to make sure that they feel adequate, to make sure that their nutritional needs are met, to make sure that they feel safe. That's not being provided at home anymore, but we have to change our approach to education to make sure kids are prepared to learn.
Let's talk about expectations.
Okay.
A lot of kids have been written off by their teachers, by the administration, by the whole system. You grew up at a time where you say that you grew up in a place, Rockford, Illinois,
yes, sir,
where you say not many dreams were ever realized.
Yeah.
Industrial town,
yeah,
Rust Belt, yada, yada. But you said also that when you were growing up, college was not an option. It was an expectation.
Absolutely.
You were going.
Mm-hmm.
And everything, your parents didn't go to college, but they were bound and determined that you would be going to college.
Right.
What about expectations? What about kids in these classrooms who don't think that they can succeed because their experience has been that they can't succeed? Should you then lower your teacher expectations, or should you raise them and hold them to it?
You absolutely raise them. You have to raise them. When you have a student, whatever a person feels that they're capable of is usually rooted and grounded in what they feel about themselves. Right. What their self-image is. And so you're automatically, before you can even prepare the ground to learn, you have to cultivated. You have to do a lot of repairing of the self-image. And that requires teachers, one, take understanding the issues that young people are dealing with when they come into your classroom that have nothing to do with learning. Two, not taking their issues personally, right? Because if I went to sleep to the sound of gunshots last night and I can't focus in your class, I'm not being insubordinate, right? I just don't know how to process this trauma. So don't kick me out. Don't lower your expectations because, you know, let's investigate what the root cause of the problem is. But you don't lower the expectations. You have to find a way to, one, tell them that they're worthy. Two, tell them that they're capable. And then three, help them chart a course to help get to that point, no matter what their starting point is. But if you really don't believe that yourself as an educator, you have to do some reevaluation. Because like I said, you have to repair that self-image before you can begin to teach.
But how do you convince them that they can succeed? If all their experience has been failure, if they've been made to feel, well, I'm not smart enough to be here, mm-hmm. I cannot process this information, how do you give them the courage to try? And fail, because they're going to fail.
Yeah, they are. You have to use that classroom teachers as your sanctuary, right? That's where, you know, people get healed at, right? So when they come in there.
But there's still that end of year grade that you have to give.
Yeah. I guess you have to place a priority on what's really important, right? So when they come in there, you have to constantly be performing surgery on their self-image, making them feel like it's okay to make mistakes. When you mess up, there's positive reinforcement. When you do well, making sure that you reward them, creating an environment in that space that's conducive to that.
How do you reward them? What works?
It's funny, man, because in high school, you would expect that the small things wouldn't work. But, man, you'll find that kids are kids. 15-year-olds enjoy candy, enjoy prizes, enjoy pats on the back, public acknowledgement. It's funny.
I read about a technique that you used in your classroom. You teach world history, and you were talking about borders, country borders, and why countries have borders and why countries go to war for natural resources.
Absolutely.
And you divided the classroom up into four sections.
Uh-huh.
And in the middle of the room – you dropped some candy.
Yeah.
And you asked them, well, look, some quarters of this classroom got more candy than the others. Would it be all right for you who got three pieces of candy to go after the nine pieces of candy that fell over there? And, mm-hmm. and they all said, no, that would be wrong. That's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So then you had them pick up the candy again, give it to you. You dropped it in the middle floor and they said, now go get it.
Uh-huh.
And they all went and got it, whatever they could get.
Right.
And the lesson was?
The lesson was, oftentimes, we may not, from our vantage point, be able to understand why people, countries do what they do. But when you are immersed in that experience, your perspective changes. And so I could have just had them read about imperialism from the textbook. You know, okay, country, this country imperialized this country. That's different from immersing them in an experience.
And you asked them why they just went after the candy on the second go round. And
right.
they said, well, because I'm hungry. And you said, so are countries.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What an effective way to teach that. How do you come up? Are you always successful at coming up with effective ways like that to teach everything about world history?
I've been mentored by some really great teachers. And, you know, that exercise is an adaptation for something I saw my mentor teacher when I was student teaching do. I took it and totally transposed it into a different environment, added elements. That's Dave McCoy. Got to shout him out.
Okay.
But you as a teacher are constantly operating under the case method. That's copy and steal everything, right? And so you're constantly looking around and finding ways that you're pulling from here and there, finding ways you can turn something into an effective lesson. And a lot of it is sitting down and really trying to figure out how you can, in a history environment, recreate the concept, synthesize the theme that you're trying to pull out. And if you can do that with students, then you've accomplished your goal. The details, the dates, the dead people, that comes later. But getting them to understand how and why, as opposed to who and what.
Well, you know, when you're teaching world history to a bunch of kids, many of them who are minorities.
Absolutely.
It occurs to me that world history... history is written by the victors.
This is true.
And world history is about a bunch of old white people in Western Europe.
How it's written.
So how do you make it relatable to people who are not of that descent?
Very excellent question. Glad you asked it. You have to be intentional about it. Okay. The curriculum says one thing, but again, you need to teach to your children. As you mentioned before, overwhelmingly African or African-American and Latino, some, you know, whites, Eastern Europeans as well. I tell them from the outset, you're going to learn about yourself. Everybody in here, you're going to learn that everybody comes from great people. But you're also going to learn that history is determined by who's writing it. And so you provide for them, if we talk about a period or an event, differing perspectives. Okay. So that if you are of European descent, Columbus discovered America, right? If you are of Native American descent, not so much, right? Yeah. Right. So we provide, you know, information, and they're able to honor other people's perspectives.
Another thing, I think you said this, or it could have been in the reading that I read peripherally about this,
right,
is that it's important for young African American kids to know,
yeah,
that their history,
yep,
did not begin with slavery.
Yeah, that's a that's a misnomer that I really try to push back against. There's this notion that, you know, black history begins with slavery and that everything prior to that has no connection. And, you know, we argue in our community over what terminology, right? But we delineate in our class from day one the difference between race, ethnicity, nationality, right? You are American, that's your nationality. Your ethnicity is African-American and your race is black. But that African piece, you are of African descent. And, you know, all they see of themselves is that they were bought, they were sold. You know, there was that whole Harlem Renaissance, there was a civil rights movement, and then for the most part, that's it. We're going to talk about Kushite empires. We're going to talk about Timbuktu. We're going to talk about Mali. We're going to talk about environments where, you know, there was an 80% literacy rate, where scholars existed and universities thrived, even while in other parts of the world, you know, they were illiterate. They have trouble arguing, oh, I can't do math or I can't do science, when they now realize it. You know what? People who look just like them invented math and science. You know what I mean? So it informs their self-image that I was talking about repairing. And the underlying theme is that everybody comes from great people who have accomplished something, right, that is worthy of being noted.
The other thing that as you talk about this, that you're teaching them is critical thinking. And I'm glad to hear it. Mm-hmm. But I'm actually amazed to hear that there's time for that, because it seems to me that if you're teaching to the the multiple choice test at the end of the year, you're teaching rote. You're not teaching thinking, but you're teaching, you know, this was written by people who won this war.
Right.
So their perspective is going to be different than the people who lost the war. Mm-hmm. But keep that in mind as you study this.
Right.
That's critical thinking.
Yeah, I was about to say, the way you phrased that was beautifully. You know, so that it's clear, okay, this is what's expected, right, when the question is asked on the test, but for your own understanding,
yeah,
right, there are multiple perspectives of what happened here, multiple accounts, and the truth, these are the skills or the tools that one uses for delineating what is true, right? There's a method, right? There's empiricism. Here's how you use that. Define that for yourself, right? Arrive at that point on your own. I'm going to give you the skill sets to be able to do that. I'm not teaching you what to think. I'm teaching you how to think. And you can't allow yourself to be controlled by the scary test at the end of year. You know, I've been fortunate. All my kids have, you know, my classes have met growth, right, since we've been analyzing that. But if you're teaching high level, if you're teaching rigorous content, okay, you got to believe that at some point your kids will also be prepared enough to pass that test.
Right.
So you can't allow the test to control the way that you administer that curriculum.
When a kid who has been failing or not succeeding, for whom school has been a miserable experience, suddenly begins to succeed, when they start to get it, when the light goes back on, mm-hmm, what is that like for you? What is that like for them?
I will be honest. There have been times where I have, and my wife would tell you, I've gone home and I've just talked about school. There's been times when I've looked and I just, you know, like a voyeur, watching them debate each other or watching them understand a concept. And I'm like, I really feel like I'm giving them a world-class education. There's been times I've said that to myself. And when you feel like you're doing what you are trying to do, that you're accomplishing that, man, I mean, I really struggle to put that into words. I don't know. It feels good. It feels great. And for them, when they know that you, when you give them props and they know that they're engaged in some high level, college level stuff and that they're excelling at it, you know, it's like they, you know, like they hit the winning shot in a basketball game. You know, they take pride from that, and they should, you know, because they're deserving of it.
Let me share with you some things that have come in while we've been talking from listeners.
Sure.
Nia on Facebook, what's the biggest obstacle to doing your job?
Figuring out the developmental level of your kids and then being able to teach to that. You can lesson plan, especially when you're new. Mm-hmm. And think, oh, yeah, the kids are going to love this, and they're gonna, I'm going to teach this, and they're going to ask this question. And then you try to go in there and they're like, huh? What? What do you? I don't understand. Can you repeat that? Figuring out developmental level of your kids and then being able to adapt lessons to that.
Grace Ann on Facebook. The wisdom Mr. Ford is sharing about teaching is something that I need at this point in the school year. What advice does he have for new teachers?
Stay the course. Make sure you're collaborating. And find yourself an excellent mentor teacher to critique you. And don't take the criticism personal. Allow it to be constructive and make you better.
You're only in your fifth year, right?
This is technically my sixth year, but I have 5 years in the classroom.
Did you have any second thoughts after the first year or two about what have I done?
No, but there was a couple of days where I was like, boy. You know, you go to sleep thinking about certain kids. They're invading your sleep. It's like, man, this kid is getting the best of me. But I can't say that I've ever second-guessed it. I can't say I ever have.
What about – you were a truant officer. I only have 30 seconds left, but you were a truant officer. What about that, talking to those kids who are habitually truant? How did that inform what you do in the classroom?
Because education is 80% relationships, 20% paperwork and pedagogy. And I learned how to build those relationships when I was a truant interview.
And you've also started a mentor program.
Absolutely.
At Garinger. You and another teacher have done this.
It was called FRESH, the Freshman Reaching Educational Success in High School. Peer mentors, upperclassmen who would then help orientate the freshmen, help make sure that they
Which makes
make
those upperclassmen feel better about
it
themselves.
It does. It develops them as leaders too. So
Somebody wants to know about whether or not you have an email address or a website. You do have a website. It is jamesford.net.
That is correct.
jamesford.net. The teacher of the year in North Carolina from CMS, a world history teacher from Garinger High School. I know you have a lot of options now, but I hope you go back to the classroom. I'm just being selfish here.
I'll be in education. You got it. Thank you.